working on this for like night and day the last year since my warrants, you know.
Well, I was
with what's been going on in the overall economy, with the airline industry, with U.S. sanctions, European sanctions.
Brilliant. So we have about a minute to go, guys. And I will just, I might just introduce your names and then I'll hand it over to Kevin. And don't forget, if you have a website or Telegram channel or whatever, because people forget, even though I remind them, because we want to drive, support all of us. You know, that's part of what we're doing to build up your platforms.
Okay, Dolores, does that sound okay? Does that sound better like that?
It does, but I think it's good if you're, if we see you, Kevin, and I'll just give you a thumbs down, because if it's okay, if everyone can raise their hands, I mean, Kevin, you'll be talking to Kevin, but when you want to come in, raise your hands. It works really well. So Kevin is like the,
I'm in the main car, guy.
So-
I'm sort of like the executive, the deputy executive, am I today?
And help fight
you're the host.
By supporting paralyzed veterans
I'm
of America.
I'm the
you're
host.
Making sure
okay.
that we have all
and you're
the food
host.
And supplies that we need.
I'm in
right
the car.
You're like the co-host.
Oh, you can help. Please go to help.
That's okay.
Don't
just that it works better if we don't talk over each other. That's why if you put the hand up on the radio,
close
it works
your eyes
well.
And think about
30
this.
Seconds.
Imagine taking your child to school where all the other kids have access to textbooks, paper, and pencils, but your child is only allowed to listen. Would you be okay with that? That's what it means to be blind. For every 100 books a sighted child can access, a blind child has access to
and if you can put yourself on mute
blind,
when you're not talking.
Help put the world at the fingertips of vision-impaired kids. Donate now at braillehouse.org.
Good morning. Oh, I love your mic.
TNT News and Talk with Dolores Cahill on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome, everyone, to the Dolores Cahill Show on tntradio.live. And you can follow me on custodian.com. And also, I have a new Telegram channel, Dolores Cahill. I'd be delighted if you would join me there. So today's show is a little bit unusual. I am handing over the hosting to one of the great minds in science today. And it is Kevin Corbett, who has been on the show before. Good morning, Kevin. And I'd be delighted if you'd like to introduce yourself and your guests.
Good morning, Dolores, and thank you very much for inviting us on. And I'll do my best being your deputy today. I feel like I'm your deputy. And
yes,
on
we're
the show
team.
Today, we've got a really great lineup, a team of brilliant minds who are going to talk about the issues of virology. And I'm Dr. Kevin Corbett. I'm a general nurse and health scientist, retired, and I've been working around these issues over the last couple of years, but well before the COVID era, in the last 30 years with HIV and AIDS. So shall I kick off, Dolores? Is that okay? Good.
Absolutely, Kevin.
So today's show is about virology. This is a practice, really, not really a scientific discipline. And the practice of virology has been ignored, has ignored the science, the modus operandi of science, the way science should be done, and has invented this whole concept of an infective pathogenic virus as the causation of human illness. And this idea of the pathogenic virus has been continually rebutted throughout its history, but it's now become an ideology. It's become an ideology, a belief system. And previously it was funded by very important institutions like the Rockefeller, Carnegie, and now the Gates Foundation and all the others. And they've capitalized on this whole concept of pathogenic virus, in the biotechnology and the pharmaceutical industry. And these have become vested interests that have captured all of our regulatory agencies. And they're pumping all these deadly products into the populations, the vaccines, the injections, the antivirals, all based on what really is belief system ideology, without any proper scrutiny or any probable cause. So within the last 2 years, people have heard a lot about the issues in virology, A lot of the truth movement, I think, in my view, and the freedom movement have really not questioned enough this whole concept of there being pathogenic viruses. And I'd like to introduce some people today who are going to, some key people who are going to talk about these issues. And I'll just quickly run through who's going to be on the show today. We're going to have Mike Stone, who's a health and wellness coach, who's created a website, a blog website called virology.com. And he's deconstructed all the major tenets of virology and shown how they are fraudulent in science in terms of the research designs and the problematic. And we have also Eric Coppolino, who's an investigative journalist and astrologer, who's written a lot about this over the last couple of years. He's created a COVID timeline, an archive of what's happened in the last 2 years, which is very novel. And he's also interviewed key people in the whole of the COVID issue, including Stephen Buston, the PCR expert. And we've also got Dr. Mark Bailey. Dr. Mark Bailey is the husband of Dr. Sam Bailey, and both are former medical practitioners and research physicians. They emanate from New Zealand, where they produce videos, articles, and books that challenge the mainstream medical claims about germ theory and the existence of viruses. They also speak out continuously against the harms of pharmaceuticals and the many aspects of allopathic medicine. And their work can be found at drsambailey.com and in the best-selling book, Virus Mania. But we've also we'll also advertise our own websites and publications as we
thanks, Kevin, and thank you, Dolores, for having us here. I'm excited to be a part of this because I get to speak about virology and whether or not, whether or not it's a science or a pseudoscience. I'm going to bear with me. It's 4 a.m. here, so I'm still not quite certain. I'm not in a lucid dream right now, but I'm going to do my best.
Thank you for getting up so early, Mike. You're a real hero. Thank you.
You're welcome. It's a fun experience. So bear with me. But so I'm going to do my best Dr. Jordan Grant impression here. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him, but if you're not, please go to my website. It's virology.com. I'll spell it. It's VIROLIEGY.com. And if you click under my presentations tab, you'll see an excellent two-part presentation that he did called Science, Pseudoscience, and the Germ Theory of Disease, where he breaks down whether or not virology is a science or a pseudoscience. So I highly recommend that. But I guess to begin with virology, let's look at the definitions for what is science and pseudoscience to begin with. And so I wrote these down. For Merriam-Webster, from the dictionary for what science is, it's knowledge or a system of knowledge covering general truths on the operation of general laws, especially as attained and tested through the scientific method. And that's important just to keep in mind the scientific method as we go through this. Pseudoscience, on the other hand, which, you know, basically means fake science. The definition from Oxford for pseudoscience is that these are theories, ideas, or explanations that are represented as scientific, but are not derived from science or the scientific method. So they have this common denominator here where we see the scientific method and whether or not this is applied appropriately. So if you have science, it's going to follow these general guidelines, the scientific method. If it's pseudoscience, you're not going to see that. So that kind of gives us a starting point on where we can go from here. The scientific method. So what is this? So this is a, you know, I actually got into a debate with someone saying that these rules don't exist, but they do. It's been around since the 17th century. And it's a set of guidelines or principles that all researchers are supposed to follow. And I've seen them anywhere from, you know, 5 general procedures on up to 7. So it just kind of depends on where you look. But I'll give basically an overview of what these steps entail and whether or not virology actually adheres to the scientific method. And so just to start off with, the first step would be observing a natural phenomenon. And so what this would entail would be, you know, if you're going outside, you see, you observe an apple fall from a tree and you're questioning what could have caused that. You know, that's observing a natural phenomenon. Or for instance, using a tree again, what if you go outside and you see it's on fire? You know, was it struck by lightning? Was there a match lit near it? Something had to cause a tree to come on fire. So you're observing this effect and you want to determine the cause. With virology, you know, they already run into problems with this first step because virologists cannot observe a virus in nature. You know, there's no ability to find these particles that they assume are viruses. They cannot see them. They don't observe the virus particles, you know, floating through the air, going through a person's nose, hijacking their body, their cells, replicating, and then being, you know, spewed out from them as they talk or cough. This is all theoretical. They don't observe this process play out in any sense of the imagination. So they already run into problems with this first step. And, you know, when you observe that phenomena, you have to understand that this is not something that, you know, it's something natural. It's not created in a lab. You know, the investigators aren't going through and creating these phenomena. They're not manipulating them. This is something that they're supposed to observe. And with virology, they don't do that. So the second step would be, after observing this natural phenomena, you would create a hypothesis called the alternate hypothesis. And in order to do so, you need a few things. You need an independent variable, which is your presumed cause, you know, the thing that you believe is causing this observed phenomena, and the dependent variable, which is the effect. And so here again, we see that virology runs into problems because they do not have this independent variable, which would be, in this instance, purified and isolated virus particles. They don't have that. So again, they're running into problems since they have methods that they can use, whether it's, centrifugation, filtration, precipitation, chromatography, different methods that they can use to try and separate the particles they believe are viruses from, you know, directly from the fluids of a human. They just don't do this. Or if they do, they do it a little bit, but they then subject it to cell culture, which we'll get into later, which is an invalid procedure. So they don't find these virus particles directly in the fluids of a human. So they don't have a valid independent variable. The dependent variable, which they get through with their cell culture process, is called the cytopathogenic effect, which is not, again, it's not a natural phenomenon. It's something that's created in the lab. And I'll explain that in a little bit as well. So we're running into problems with the scientific method from the first two steps. You know, they can't even get to the point of creating a hypothesis because they do not observe the virus going into someone in order to cause them to become sick. So, along with creating an alternate hypothesis, you'd have your null hypothesis, which, you know, if you believe a virus causes disease, so your hypothesis, these particles cause this disease, these symptoms of disease, the null hypothesis would be that these particles do not cause this disease. After that, we'd get to testing and an experimentation, which again, virology would not be able to get to without having that independent variable that the researchers can vary and manipulate in order to see if it's causing the effect that they're observing. After we do testing and experimentation, they would, you know, observe, or they would make their observations, they'd get their data, they'd analyze it. And after that, you know, they would test to see if the hypothesis is valid or if it's invalid. And so, as I said, this whole process does not, or is not carried out in science. So, or not in science, in virology. So technically it would not be a science, it'd be a pseudoscience. Now, as they do not have their purified and isolated particles, their you know, their valid independent variable, what they don't have, you know, direct evidence for the existence of the particles that they assume are a virus. So what they do is they go through indirect evidence, various modes of indirect evidence to try and prove that these viruses exist. So just to break down, direct evidence would be, you know, that the, you know, the evidence that can prove your point that does not require the interpretation of the, you know, the person, the investigators or the researchers. Indirect evidence is a different facts that if they turn out to be true, which, you know, is a big if it turns out to be true, then you can infer that this evidence proves, you know, the existence of a virus. So, you know, it's a key distinction to make that they do not have the direct evidence, they have this indirect evidence. And the first form of indirect evidence would be the cell culture method, which is where they are taking the sample from a human. We'll just use SARS-CoV-2 as an example because that's on everyone's mind. So in this instance, they took the lung fluid of a single patient and, you know, they'll take that fluid and they might centrifuge it a little bit, maybe try and get rid of some of the bigger particles. And then they add that to a culture of, in this case, it was the kidney cells from an African green monkey. And so they take the sample from the human, put it in the cell culture. They'll mix that with different antibiotics, antifungals, fetal cow serum, the blood from a baby calf, and other chemicals and nutrients. And they'll incubate that for a few days and they'll look to see if they get what is called the cytopathogenic effect, which is, you know, the breakdown of the cell as it's been starved and poisoned. So they're literally creating the effect that they want to see and then claiming that when they get this effect, that is proof of their virus. So it's indirect evidence that they're creating in a lab trying to claim the existence of these pathogenic particles. And so that's not a valid dependent variable because they're creating their effect that they're observing. And they don't have the viruses to begin with in order to, you know, see that effect. So that's one form of indirect evidence. The next one would be the electron microscopy images that you'll see of these scary particles, the scary pathogenic particles. And again, what they're doing with these, they're taking, you know, the supernatant from this cell culture. And so at this point, it's already heavily altered. You know, the sample has gone through the cell culture process. It's not purified. It's not free of contaminants. It's not free of foreign materials, pollutants. It's not free of different, you know, things outside of the particles. It's not just the particles, the viruses itself. It's a mixture. It's not isolated. So they take that heavily altered sample and they'll put it through this electron microscope preparation where they fix the sample. They kill it with formaldehyde and glutaraldehyde. They will stain it with different heavy metals. Well, first they'll dehydrate it, I believe, with different concentrations of ethanol. Then they'll stain it with heavy metals. They'll put it in epoxy resin, cut it into thin sections, and then bombard it under an electron microscope with all this heat. And so, again, you're taking an already heavily altered sample and putting it through more alterations, taking images from this heavily altered sample, and then claiming that the particles that you see at the end were actually in the person to begin with, which at that point is so far removed from reality. You know, how can you say that the particles that you're picking out in these images were actually in the person to begin with? And, you know, it's interesting, as I've been doing research into this, the recent one I was looking into was the Marburg virus, and the electron microscope, the person who was doing that wrote a paper and said it took them, like, I believe days to try and find the particles in these electron microscope images. And the person, the lead researcher, actually left. They were frustrated. They couldn't find the virus that they were looking for. And he left and then came back an hour later and they're like, oh, there it is. So they were just looking through this unpurified sample and found the particles, these filaments that they had said, oh, we haven't seen those before. We call it the point and declare method. You know, you're looking for the representative particle that you believe is your virus and then claiming that is without actually, you know, proving that to be the case. So electron microscope imaging, again, another form of indirect evidence. Another one that they like to use is antibodies. So they're saying that these results with these antibodies are evidence that the virus is within a sample. We run into problems here because antibodies, again, never been purified and isolated directly from the fluids of a human. These are just different chemical reactions. And like viruses, antibodies existed first as an idea. You know, it was a concept that was created to explain these reactions. And they have no less than six theories trying to explain the form and function of these entities. So, you know, you can't use one fictional entity to try to explain the existence of another fictional theoretical entity, which is what they're trying to do with these antibody results. If they get them, they claim that they're specific to a certain virus, and that proves the existence of this virus. But what you find out when you do research antibodies is that these results regularly are not specific. You know, they don't just go on to the virus that they're looking for. These reactions bind to all sorts of different things. And antibody research in itself is embroiled in the reproduction crisis, or they can't reproduce and replicate the antibody results. So, you know, these, again, it's just another form of indirect evidence that they're trying to use to infer the existence of these viruses. That leads us to genomic or genomes, the data that they will use to try and create a genome to say that this virus exists. And these are just, you know, random ACTGs in a computer database that they've cobbled together off of these unpurified samples. So once again, in the case of SARS-CoV-2, it came from the lung fluid of a single patient. I don't believe they even did any sort of centrifugation, if I remember correctly. They just did a metagenomic sequencing, which, you know, you're going to find a bunch of host material, different things, bacteria, fungus, all these different elements that will be sequenced along with the theoretical virus.
Thanks, and so, Mike.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Am I going too long? So,
no, that's okay.
Basically, there's a lot of different forms of indirect evidence.
Yeah. I think you've outlined all the methodological problems in this whole area called virology. And the key thing for me from that is they're working with an idea and they're projecting an idea into what they're observing. And that's really profoundly unscientific. So that's a really important issue, the virtual. You know, they're looking at the idea, they're obsessed with this idea. And you can see from the history of it, they've been obsessed with it from the 19th century onwards. This idea of there being this unseen agent that they can cut, they think they can culture, and they think that they can envisage in all sorts of ways, and they can only capture it in these cultures, they say, but they can't actually identify it materially as a real entity, a material biological phenomenon that you can see, you can sense in all sorts of direct ways. They can only do it in indirect ways. And I think this sort of leads into this issue about the virtual and the whole abstraction from reality that you see in this practice called virology, which in a sense isn't a science as in a predictive discipline that can predict and it can control in terms of experimentation, and it can replicate its experiments and find exactly the same findings. And I think this brings us on to talk a little bit about this whole area of the virtual. And I wonder if we could bring in Eric here to tie in, because Eric's done a lot of work. Eric Coppolino, investigative journalist and astrologer, has done a lot of work recently on this whole area of how virology and COVID and SARS-CoV-2 actually is a virtual phenomenon and ties in with this sort of transhumanist agenda at some point. So Eric, could you perhaps jump in here?
Good morning to everyone from New York. And thank you, Kevin. Hi, Dolores. Hi, Mark and Mike. The whole thing that we've witnessed is all going on inside of computers. I think people have this idea that virology is going on in a laboratory, and maybe some part of it is going on inside of a laboratory. But when you actually look at what's going on, it's almost entirely a computer phenomenon. And I think that defies most people's comprehension of what a physical science like virology is. When you tell people that you've dug up some rock, you know, you're studying a rock, they expect you to actually have a rock. And when you're studying a star out in space, they expect you to actually have the star out in space. And when you're studying a bunny rabbit, they expect you to have the bunny rabbit. But with virology, somehow, no one actually has the virus, but what they have is a kind of a representation of what they claim is the virus that's in a computer program. And when you start to look at what they're actually doing, you find out that it really has absolutely nothing to do with the physical world. All of the brew going on that Mike was talking about, all of their monkey pus and calf pus and everything else, it's almost like a it's an excuse, basically, to make it seem like they've done something that is going to be repeatable or has a basis in physical reality. But very quickly, all of that is going on inside of a computer, and they're doing all this alignment, and they're running computer programs over and over again, basically. And I don't think that's something that's widely understood. And I'm finding in explaining this over and over again that one of the best ways to explain what's going on is to say this is not happening in the real world. It's happening inside of the processor on a computer. And people do understand that. They understand the concept of a simulation as opposed to a real thing. There's still enough awareness of that. We're not so deep into the world of deep fake. But what we really are talking about, and this is starting to get some traction in the press. I think there might have been a 60 Minutes on it a few weeks ago, and you'll see articles starting to pop up, is that there's this thing now called a deep fake, which is a computer simulation. We could have the Dolores Cahill deep fake based on collecting hundreds of hours of your broadcasts and your vocal patterns, and then making a script, and this little digital puppet of Dolores comes on the air. You can be floating around on a sailboat in the Bahamas, and your brand new show is still happening. And this is the best approximation of what's been going on with virology that I can think of. But the second problem is that people's minds have been changed. I mean, really, it's the first problem. It's more like the prime cause, is that people's entire set of references have been completely scrambled and put back together by all overexposure to all of this technology. And it has not left people with any natural, innate, with much intelligence that they can access because they have been so disoriented by being completely over-immersed in digital technology for the past 20 years, even longer. All of your young people are now digital natives. They grew up with a computer on the kitchen table or were handed a phone, a cell phone when they were two. And that has, in a sense, ruined people's ability to reason through issues like this. And so in a way, they have become part of the problem themselves, because when someone's mind is in digital state, you can convince them of almost anything. And we've long been, first of all, convinced, trained about the existence of viruses by having the needle shoved in our arm so many times, right? That's very convincing, right? When you're two and they shove the needle in your arm, you think there must be a good reason for this. It must be really doing something. This is a complete violation of your whole physical reality. This is not a pill that you take. Even that's more natural. You peel some bark off a tree. Okay, no, this is just they're gonna go in through some mystery pathway, shoving this liquid into your body. That's convincing. And on top of that, add this complete transformation by computers, and part of that conditioning means to be completely faithful of anything claiming to be high tech. And so the way back at the beginning, I was in a conversation here. How many minutes? A minute? Two?
No, three. I was just going to say, Eric, thank you very much seconds. For that. And just yeah, if it's so there okay you go. That we're just going to quickly, no, we'll come back to you after the break, but just on the Dolores Cahill Show and with my guest host of Kevin Corbett and my guests, Mike Stone and Dr. Mark Bailey, and also Eric Coppolino. We're just going to go to a quick ad break and we'll be back again in 2 minutes.
You should hear what George Eliason is talking about.
One of the great frontline journalists.
Well done. Listen, we've lost Kevin, which is interesting.
Yeah, he's from his car, I guess, down by the shore.
Yeah, if he doesn't come back, Dolores, do you just want to take over and...
I will. And we'll go along with the same plan. Is that okay? And Eric, you were wonderful. Yep. So I didn't mean to interrupt you. It's just normally we have two outbreaks and I only get one. That's perfect. No, it's fine. And then we'll just go to you, Mark, as well, after Eric. So Eric, you have whatever, 10 minutes or whatever you want. And then we'll come to Mark. And then in the second hour, we'll just be the general discussion and you guys can lead it in a way, you know. But I'm sure Kevin will be back, so we don't have to worry. There he is.
Sorry if I droned on too long. I apologize. I was like,
No, you were really good, actually, because it's not easy, Mike, to explain the scientific method. I was taking notes. I thought, fair play to you. You know what we did in science is you just change one thing at a time and you have like multiple positive controls and negative controls, right? Yeah. It's quite easy. And I do think we should be asking, and I will be part of my court cases, is to get them to give us the positive control and the virus and the controls for the PCR test. Because under the law, fraud unravels all, right? So it's going to get really tricky for them.
Yeah, it's been interesting, Dolores, because, you know, Christine Massey and her colleagues have been pushing for this stuff. And the universities, all of the institutions, they just refuse to hand over this information. And we keep getting referred to like protocols, websites and all this kind of rubbish. Or they refer us back to
the... You know, there's a warrant out for my arrest, right? So if I'm arrested, I will be asking you guys to then go and ask for it every day I'm there, right? I'm only there because of this virus, eh?
Yeah, I mean, it's a total... The responses we're getting are just getting more and more stupid. And
cool. But Kevin, if you want to introduce back Eric, or will I? You can, Kevin, if that's okay. And then Eric.
Yeah, Eric. Sorry, I lost the connection, so I'm back on now. Did you finish what you were saying about
vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702.
Okay.
Or read more at mitmodular.com.
There's an issue with my audio, guys. So, Kevin, if you can. Can you introduce him back when he comes?
I don't know where to begin.
Everybody, I will do, yeah.
TMT.
Where's the cue?
I call it the Oh My God virus.
Why do we give him the power?
Absolutely stupid.
Of course, it's ridiculous.
And it just goes along with everything else.
For them to actually mandate a vaccine.
Get a straight talk from us.
Time for us to be bold and be strong.
TMT.
And I wanted to thank you for that.
Telling the truth is the only mandate we believe in.
When you get into the facts and logic and reason thing, it drives me crazy because you're right.
TMT Radio.
I just was calling to give you my 2 cents.
TMTRadio.live.
Eric, you were talking about the whole virtual issue and the fact that these so-called viruses are computer constructs, really. They're algorithmic creations, and that people don't really understand this. And what do you think is the issue here about bringing this to a wider audience, this what actually is happening, which is a, you know, this in silico modeling, this computer generated material, which doesn't have any direct translation to something from nature. It's not a surrogate of something from nature.
I think we have to keep talking about it over and over again until we find language that people resonate with. So this is one of the reasons why I've been writing the current series of articles that I'm doing now. I've moved that project onto Substack, where I'm just basically explaining this over and over and over again from different angles, conducting a kind of an experiment to see what resonates with people, what concepts they identify with, and to introduce the concepts behind the technical language before introducing the technical language and the technology, because when you go from the concept to the word, the concepts are easy, and so you go from the concept to the word to the technique, I think you may get a better result. So when we have to explain this to the human race, we're having to explain it to people who are enamored of technology and hypnotized by technology, but don't understand technology. They don't know the words. And so this is all a very long experiment in plain talk. One of the reasons why I thought Sam Bailey was the most engaging presenter I had ever seen is because she is the expert in plain talk, in getting it out of the technological jargon, because the jargon itself has a kind of a hypnotizing quality. And as Jesus did, we have to learn how to speak in metaphors that are simple enough that people can understand them. Now, people could go a long way toward understanding Jesus's very simple metaphors. I think those also get lost, but they're also heavily abused. But that idea of what is an example, what is this like? A good trial lawyer speaks like this. What do people know at the time they make a statement? This is a very important thing, and I think it's one of the we can maybe come back to that later. But a lot of the people who are dancing around the point that there is not a virus, who are refusing to answer the question, one of the things they're caught in is the thing I've seen liars caught in many, many times, which is that how do they come around to admitting when they knew what they knew? So the problem is if child of a famous politician, for example, does manage to admit that this doesn't exist, well, the question might be, well, when did you find that out? And so I think that when did you find that out question is causing a delay in people acknowledging what they know. And so another part of what we need to do is open the door rhetorically allow an opening for people to and maybe explain why they didn't follow this or put this all together. So we're having to translate between technology and real life, and that's not easy in a world where nobody really understands their technology that well. They even I mean, I do customer service. I mean, I do some customer service for my company, right? Where I watch the emails go by, I pick up the phone, and it rings. And we live in a time when people have a hard time resetting a password. They cannot tell the internet from their email inbox. They are completely disoriented, dislodged, and confused. They don't know how to get around the physical world because it's got a voice from the sky giving them instructions. Whereas it's much easier to learn how to get around if you like to get lost and drive down that back road and see where it comes out on the other end. So that spirit of explore and experiment in the physical world is a thing that has to be stoked in people as curiosity. Where does that road lead? And so part of what I do as a writer is try to engage people and incite their curiosity in a certain way, and let their, like a therapy process, let their curiosity, their desire for self-actualization be driving the questions. And so I think if we can put good questions out, then we're doing ourselves a big favor. And we, people who think about this all day long, right? I know everyone in this room except Dolores, who I've watched for many years now, 3 years, doing your thing with audiences. We should be practicing in little practice sessions, looking for the language, just like the people who thought this up. I would put a large sum of money on focus groups being behind a lot of the language of this, and I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if Frank Luntz personally ran the focus groups. When you've got all this brilliant language like killing grandma, social distancing, you know, all this protect your neighbor BS, this came out of, far as I know, this came out of focus groups. And the fear, they understand the fear. Now, the reason I'm saying this with such confidence is that Fauci himself said that they focus group influenza, cancer, AIDS. They are looking for the public to provide its language. Then they turn it back to the public. We need to be doing that. We need to be watching our email inbox and listening to the stupid questions people are asking and the complaints they're making, and use all of that data to find the language to tell this story.
Well, what you're saying there, Eric, about virology, it was obsessed from the early days with technology and techniques. Mm. And the whole history of molecular biology as well, Dolores, is one from the 1930s where biological reality, the phenomena of biology, the materiality of the flesh, was superseded by physicists, by physics, by mathematics, and people were brought in or brought themselves into the field, funded by Carnegie and Rockefeller, to colonize the biological with the physical. So you had this superseding of the materiality with fiction, with abstraction, with mathematics. And you can see that in the way that the work on the bacteriophage was used to galvanize the whole model of pathogenic infectious viruses. Rather than looking at the whole thing objectively, they projected into this whole area this fiction of there being a virus, of there being an infection, of there being lysis, and they couldn't prove that model. It was disproved, and it still is disproved as a pathogenic infective model. And that's where we are today, because that's what the biotech and the pharma industries have got behind. It's been capitalized upon. It's been marketed. Mm-hmm. And it's been legitimated through all the regulatory mechanisms. And therefore, that's the end result. Mm-hmm. You know, if you accept the tenets, the axioms and postulates of virology, then you have a virus, you have social distancing, you have all this infection control, which is totally unnecessary if there is nothing there. And there isn't, I think, there isn't anything there. I think it is a fiction. I think it's like the 19th century dilettante scientists. Now in the 21st century, they're not dilettantes running around on horseback, they're actually not amateurs, they're professionals with techniques and modern versions of 19th century amateur approaches, which are high-tech PCR tests, lateral flow tests, antibody tests. But these all depend on what Mike was talking about, the way that they manipulate the independent and dependent variables, the lack of proper research designs and controls, and the lack of proper, I mean, accepted experimentation, in canonical experimentation, the true experiment. They're doing one-shot case designs where they throw bits of a sample into a load of material. It's like an alchemy. It's like a witch's brew of genetic and biological confounding variables. And then, hey presto, they have CPE, cytopathic effect, which, as Mike was saying, is there's no metric to it. It's totally interpretive, depends on the subjectivity of the operator in the lab. This is not a science. This is a practice. It's really dilettante 19th century approaches dressed up with modern day techniques. And Mark, you've deconstructed this an awful lot in your first paper last year on the, where you went through all the pillars of the COVID con. And perhaps you could jump in here really and take this a little bit further.
Yeah, thank you, Kevin. And yeah, it would be a pleasure to build on what the rest of the panel have just talked about. So first of all, based on what Mike was saying about what is science, what is the scientific method, I'd like to start just by reading a short extract of a recent article I wrote called Warning Signs You Have Been Tricked by Virologists Again. And I added a wee postscript at the finish, and it was derived from Alan Chalmers, the philosopher of science, his book that he published in, it was a second edition, What is This Thing Called Science, in 1982. So I derived my postscript on his work and said, observational statements are frequently presupposed by theory. Such statements are always made in the language of some theory and will be precise as the theoretical or conceptual framework that they utilize is precise. So in this instance, a virus particle was not observed first, and subsequently viral theory and pathology developed. Scientists of the mid and late 19th century were preoccupied with the identification of imagined contagious pathogenic entities. The observations of that naive inductionist did not identify a virus a priori and then set about studying its properties and characteristics. The extant presupposition of the time was that a very small germ particle existed that may explain contagion. What came thereafter arose to fulfill the presuppositional premise. So the point of that is saying that essentially the virologists invented viruses in their minds and then went about trying to find observations which would confirm their theory, which is a completely backwards way of going about things. And I think what few people realize is that since the 1800s, virology has essentially remained what we call a descriptive science. Now, when a science is new, when it's something completely unknown to humanity previously, a descriptive science, that's fine. We start to observe, make some speculation about what could be going on. And really, it's just a starting point. Some sciences are stuck as descriptive at the moment. So for things like describing planets or stars, et cetera, we can't really do experimental studies. We can't do controlled studies to test if our hypotheses are correct. So they remain descriptive sciences. But for virology to remain as a descriptive science in the year 2022 is absolutely preposterous. And we think that it's been kept this way to maintain the illusion that viruses actually exist. So realistically, when the light microscope was invented, and certainly by the 1700s and the 1800s, the scientists and doctors were observing microbes under the microscope and trying to reach conclusions about what they might do, whether they cause disease, etc. That's all fine. That's all descriptive science. But once you're at that point, it should become an experimental science, as Mike alluded to earlier, where you start dealing with independent variables and controlled experiments. But we can see that virology has not been doing that for the last 140 years. It's simply remained in this descriptive phase. So initially in the late 1800s, it was thought to be some sort of fluid contagion. By the early 1900s, they thought it was an infectious protein. And by the 1950s, it became the modern model that we have today, which is the rogue genetic code surrounded by a protein coat that passes around causing infections and is replication competent. The problem with that is that each reincarnation of the virus has not been backed up by following scientific method with controlled experiments. And we can see that certainly in the 1970s, they were attempting to purify what they thought were viral particles. But there were a number of problems. One was that the particles could never be found directly from a living host. And that's a major problem. Now, we see all sorts of excuses that the virologists make up about this, from that there's just not enough to it's just not practical, etc. But then we find that it's a completely inconsistent model, because if there's not enough virus load to detect, then how on earth is it causing damage within the body? And we're also getting other explanations, such as a sneeze might contain 200 million viruses. And yet when we capture a sneeze and put it under the microscope, we can't see one virus in there. So again, we just see excuse after excuse as to why the scientific method can't be applied, essentially. So one of the important activities that's taken place in the last 2 years, particularly with regards to SARS-CoV-2, is Christine Massey and allies' work that's been taking place with their Official Information Act request. And one thing that's become very apparent is that none of these institutions, whether it's the CDC or the major universities and private institutions, have been doing controlled experiments. So when they're claiming that they've cultured a virus, that they've come up with the genomic sequence of a virus, whether they've created a PCR or antigen test, which they say detects the virus, whether they've come up with an antibody test, which they say predicts exposure to the alleged virus, none of these things have been done with properly controlled experiments. So they're all completely invalid. And I think what's happened is that people are waking up to this, and we're sort of closing in on the virologists, and there's not a lot of room for them to move anymore. So some of the excuses we're seeing now are just getting, quite frankly, ridiculous. So Christine and her team have shared with me some of the pertinent responses from some of the major institutions. And the excuses we're getting are anything from it's too much work to generate the data, or it's going to cost too much money, right through to it poses a threat to national security, through to alleging that we may be creating some sort of bioweapon. Now, this is all completely ridiculous, because all we've asked for in these instances is just to show us the control experiment that took place so we can see that there was an independent variable. So if they are doing a cell culture, we're just saying to them, that's fine. You're saying that the cytopathic effect and the particles that you're seeing in the culture are viruses. Why don't you just do it with a controlled experiment? Now, we're not talking about negative controls, which they like to give us, which is simply adding water, culture media to the sample. We need to see a proper positive control where they add the same sort of biological specimen. So in this case, it might be some fluid from the nose or from the lung. But this particular sample doesn't contain the alleged virus. That's what an appropriate positive control experiment is. But we can see that they simply do not do this, or if they have been doing it, they don't disclose it to us. And we know from Stefan Lanka's experiments that he did last year that you can generate all of these things, whether it be the cytopathic effect in a cell culture or a genome alleged to come from a virus. You can simply do this through a control experiment where you don't add anything that possibly contains what they alleged to be a virus. Now, many of us have been aware that this has been going on for a long time, so this is not something new. But as Kevin and Eric have been suggesting, we're trying to work out ways to engage more of the public so they know what's going on. And one of the initiatives we launched in mid-July was the Settling the Virus Debate Statement, which is essentially a public challenge to the virologists, just saying, well, you're telling us that your PCR and your cell cultures and your genomics are detecting viruses. So we'd just like to see you, firstly, on your own terms, just to see if you've got any internal validity with what you do. Do the same thing, but this time do it blinded so that you don't know the nature of the samples that you're getting. So we came up with the basic protocol involving split samples that we'd send to 5 different labs around the world. And we'd ask them to see what they could find in each sample. Tell us, does this sample contain a virus or not? Does this sample contain a viral genome or not? And for the first time, apparently in history, we'd see if they can even perform with any form of internal validity on their own terms. Now, we don't even think that that would prove the concept of viruses. It would just be step one to say, with what's being presented to the world currently, does it show what they're doing have any scientific merit whatsoever? So interestingly, we put the statement forward in the middle of last month, so we're almost 6 weeks now, and not once has anyone stepped forward and said that you guys are mistaken, because these tests have already been done. These experiments have already been done. Now, that is staggering. That is an absolute staggering admission, because shouldn't this stuff have been done with fully controlled experiments, not just once, but multiple times and tested? So I think that was the first incredible revelation. And obviously the second is that the establishment don't want anything to do with it. We've had some attacks from the health freedom community, interestingly, but the virologists themselves, I think they can see that it's just a matter of time.
That's great. Thank you very much, Mark, if that's okay. We're just going to come at the end of the first hour. And our guest today, of course, the host is Kevin Corbett, and we have Mike Stone from America, Dr. Mark Bailey from New Zealand, and also Eric Capolio from America. And we're just now going to, at the top of the hour, to take a break for the news. And we'll be back for the next hour on the Dolores Cahill Show on TNTRadio.live.
If you missed this hour, simply go to
episodes. They cut me off. My Zoom went off completely. So I didn't have time to hand over to you, Kevin, if that's okay. But I think it's excellent, guys. What do you think?
World-renowned author Salman Rushdie spent the week in hospital, lucky to be alive.
And Kevin, if you want to, when we come back, I'll just say Dolores Cahill Show, whatever, because I have to do that for TNT Radio, and then you can take over. But I thought Eric's thing about the hypnosis and everything, I think the way you're doing is gently explaining to people the con and the hoax in a questioning, loving way. I think that actually will have a lot of impact.
Yeah, you should read Mike's articles. He doesn't do it in a loving way in his articles. you cut to the business, don't you, Mike?
Yeah, I think everybody's really, really good. When we come back, I'll try and sort of draw some themes just to throw out there from what everybody said and offer some sort of historical explanation for why this is as it is. And we can then kick back into all of your individual themes there. And, exploring some of the things. Eric will want to explore some of his themes. Mike will come back with his methodological issues. And Mark, I think it's great the way you came on there and what you said in relation to what's been happening, and also bringing in the viral, settling the virus debate challenge. And actually, Kevin McCarran did come back to me on the Corman Drosten Review email list and said that it had all been done. And wait for this. But I did ask him on a, I didn't go to the whole group, but I just said, Kevin, could you send me what's been done? Because I can't, we can't see it. And he didn't come back to me. You know, it's one of those, you know, just.
You know, it would be so easy to, you know, if they did have a positive control or whatever, to get it checked by 10 labs, right? It would be so easy. But we're probably not going to talk about it now, but it means that, like, the money that the politicians spent to the pharmaceutical industry. Yeah, because I keep saying, what did the pharmaceutical industry make the vaccine against, right? That's a very simple question. Mm-hmm. But they got a lot of money. And now it's not about money, as we know. It's about killing people. But for ordinary people to go, well, what were the PCR tests against, or what was these antigen tests against, and what did the pharmaceutical industry make the vaccines against?
Yeah, but the whole vaccine thing, that's been going on for, you know, over 100 years. Oh, I know. Yeah, I mean, they literally inject crap into people, biological
Marks. The most toxic things in the world.
I'll take the dog shit, personally.
I think that's the big wake-up call for a lot of people, and including myself. I mean, I knew 20 years ago that the vaccines were an issue. But by that time, I'd had all the childhood vaccines, and I'd had some of the adult ones as well. So, you know, we've all been caught like flies in flypaper with all this. You know, we're all mired in it to some extent of our generation. And maybe our
And there is the fertility issue. There is the issue around fertility as well in HPV and tetanus. Now, we're going to come back in a few seconds, I think.
That's HELPPVA.org.
Join the pink frilly tutus. Join the walkers, the joggers, the runners.
Join the people remembering friends, family, loved ones.
Join the kids, the mothers, the grannies.
Join those who are living with cancer.
I'll just introduce you, Kevin, and then over to you.
Join the most fantastic day. Join the 5 and 10
Don't forget to say your websites again,
guys. In the fight
guys.
To beat cancer. Join the girls this summer at Tesco and Cancer Research UK's Race for Life.
And your Telegram channel.
Join now. Find an event near you at raceforlife.org.
You're in with Dolores Cahill on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Dolores Cahill Show on tntradio.live. And you can find me on my new Telegram channel, Dolores Cahill, and also on custodian.com. And I'm going to hand it over now to the host today, Kevin Corbett. And our joint guests today are Mike Stone and Eric Coppolino, and also Dr. Mark Bailey from New Zealand. Over to you, Kevin.
Thank you, Dolores. And we've heard in the first hour some really interesting data about the whole practice of virology going back to the 19th century. And most people, when you say this to them, you know, the whole area or discipline it's called of virology is groundless or is unscientific. It's very interesting, the response from lay people, scientists, quite varied. And I've tried to uncouple this and discover why over the last 2 years, why this situation arose historically. And there's a lot of work out there. There's a lot of scholarship to throw light on this. We've heard today from Dr. Mark Bailey, and who works with Dr. Sam Bailey in New Zealand. They've done a lot of work uncovering this. Eric Coppolino, investigative reporter in America, has done a lot of work on this. And so is Mike Stone with his virology.com website. I've put a lot of work out there over the years. I've done a lot of work on this, or tried to do, and through my website, kevinpcorbett.com, and my citizen science Telegram channel, Kevin Corbett, PhD. And looking at the science, the history of the science, I think is quite key here. And the history of how molecular biology arose from the 1920s onwards is very key to understanding where we are with all these issues today. And the development of molecular biology from biology was really a technology transfer from areas like chemistry and physics into biological sciences in the 1920s and 30s. And the biological sciences were really focused on the material reality of organisms and their physical presence and their characterization became colonized with interests from the other scientists, sciences like physics and chemistry, where the shift became towards the abstract and the virtual. You saw this in the work in the 1930s on the bacteriophage that was led by Max Delbruck, who was a physicist who became a biophysicist later in life, but he was a quantum physicist in the 1920s and 30s and brought into biology this focus on the bacteriophage and on abstracting this phenomenon into statistical variables that could be manipulated in all sorts of mathematical ways, which had very little to do with the biological reality of bacteriophages. I think this is quite key, this history, to what's happened today, where we've got this focus on genetic sequencing and genetic manipulation of so-called viruses, but no focus on their biological reality, their actual entities. And this is why I think the research of Christine Massey is quite key, because it's pointing a light on this area today in the 21st century. Our public health authorities and agencies like the CDC and the UK HSA are not interested in the biological entity of viruses. They don't have any physical samples of them. And is that because these things don't actually exist or don't exist in the ways we've been told they exist? And I think this is key, going back to what happened in the 20s and 30s and looking at this work again, looking at the work of the bacteriophage scientists, looking at how they could not prove the infection model. They couldn't prove a pathogenic infective bacteriophage. And that was really key. So what they did was they used a lot of technology, they used a lot of mathematics, and they developed workarounds. They developed sort of ways of going around the observations that couldn't be explained by their model. So they're projecting into their data and their observations a whole imaginary model of an infective pathogenic virus. And it just did not fit. And when it didn't fit, they walked around that data, they walked around it, they developed workarounds. One area of this with the bacteriophage was where they could not prove that it infected bacteria. So they developed this concept called the eclipse phase. And this is another area where they also had to develop a workaround, was in the electron microscopy of bacteriophages, where they showed, looking at it ostensibly on paper, on the EMs, they said that these things had a head and they had a tail. And then after many years, one of the electron microscopists, Andrews, discovered that what they were looking at with the so-called tails of bacteriophages were just artifacts of the way these samples had been prepared for the microscopy slides. And this is an amazing discovery, that this was artifactual. And of course, this really lends itself to the work of Harold Hillman in the 1960s and 70s, who really underscored the whole of electron microscopy with many questions about what actually is it that they're looking at, and is what they're looking at artifactual? Are they artifacts of the way these things have been prepared and not actual structures, not actual entities? So again, this is bringing us back to the 21st century and the whole in silico modeling of viruses, this whole approach really that is technically driven, technologically driven. It's not driven by material biology, by the focus on the phenotype. It's focusing on genetic fragments and abstractions and virtual realities. And I do think that this is where we are with this. I do think an historical analysis is quite important here. So I'd like to bring back in some of our speakers from the first hour. Maybe you could pick up on this, Mark, with what you were saying earlier before the break, and we could then bring back in Mike and Eric.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Kevin. Yeah, I think it is one concept that Eric's picked up on is this in silico world of virology. And I think very few people do understand what actually happens in the science of virology. There is what they call a wet lab pipeline, which is where they actually have the samples and process them. But these days they're so anxious to get them into the dry lab pipeline, which is the in silico world. It's almost like they don't care anymore. They just want the samples to come in. They want to process them through automated machines and then start to sequence what they can find. But I mean, most of us, we're not denying that they can't find these sequences from environmental samples. What we're saying is that the significance of them clinically and biologically is completely incorrect. So we've got these whole fields now of genomics and proteomics, which supposedly are very high-tech, very well-funded operations. But those of us that are actually looking into them and applying the scientific method are saying these don't tell you anything about health, disease, and well-being. And I think that's where the public are being completely misled. So one thing you might see is when one of us on the panel says that the virus doesn't exist, that they might say, well, I went to GenBank or GSAID and I see it's been found 12 million times. So how could that be wrong? And what we're saying is that they're just doing the same loop of the same track over and over again. So if you say that you've got some sequences that belong to a virus, and then other people go out and find the same sequences, because someone's already declared that they're a virus, everyone else thinks they're finding the virus too. What we're saying is we need to see a step where you show that there is a virus and that the sequences that you're finding come from inside the virus. And same with the proteins that can be detected. We need to see, well, we need to see a particle purified and characterized so that we know the proteins come from this particular virus. So this is the whole problem of how they create a fake epidemic, is that people think that the detection of these sequences through PCR and genomics, or detection of proteins through things like the antigen or lateral flow test, mean that people are picking up the virus or being infected with the virus when you don't need that at all. And I mean, it can be pointed out, probably the public can understand things like we can perform a PCR on an orange or a dog or some environmental sample, a puddle that you find on your driveway. And all of these things can supposedly test positive. But what does that mean? That you've found some proteins or some genetic sequences? It means absolutely nothing. Yes. So what we see these days is inventions of epidemics through testing, basically.
Yeah.
And when I say testing, I put that in quotes because they're not really tests as such. They're just molecular chemical reactions done in vitro, which have nothing to do with the health of a human or an animal.
Yes.
So
I think what you're saying there, Mark, is really important, because the application of these technologies in the public sphere lends credibility and legitimacy to the concept of the virus. When, as you're saying, it's the interpretation of those outcomes that's important. And I think this is also what you're saying is very important, that our critique is not an anti-science critique. Ours is a true scientific critique, because we were questioning and critiquing the methods by which they've arrived at these technologies, which is what Mike was saying earlier in terms of the lack of true research designs. And I do think that that's a very important thing to put out there. We are not anti-scientists. We are true scientists. We're saying that the scientific method hasn't been properly applied here at all. It hasn't even been applied in a rudimentary way. But these technologies, their licensing and fast-tracking into health services has given credence to the whole concept of the virus when it hasn't been proven to exist in the first place. So I think the technology's gone ahead of itself here, or rather the technology's gone ahead of the science. Would you agree then, Mark, with this?
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing that we do as citizen scientists, and both Sam and I do this, and Mike Stone on Virology does this as well, is that we don't start like most people do and say there's an epidemic and people are getting sick and there's a virus passing around. I mean, that's just something that a newspaper article can report without any scientific analysis whatsoever. So what we do is we follow scientific trails right back to the start. So if there's a claim that there is an entity called a coronavirus, we just don't accept that we get shown a picture and one or two scientific papers that claim that coronaviruses exist. We actually follow the trail right back as far as it will go. So with coronaviruses, that usually takes us back to the 1960s when quite a few publications started to come out. Through to the 1980s when they claimed to sequence coronaviruses for the first time and get their entire genomes. But the thing is, when we've taken a deep dive into the literature, we've not found any evidence of viruses, because there'll be claims. There's one study that will just get piggybacked onto another study. And when you follow it all the way back to the start, we always find with every single virus, we get to the same problem, that the foundational papers do not show an infectious particle that is passing around and making people or other hosts sick. So the whole thing is fraudulent. Yeah. And it is difficult. And I would say to people, a lot of people listening to this stuff for the first time will be saying, but what about this? But what about measles? But what about chickenpox? And what you need to do in those situations is usually the best thing to do is go to Mike's website, Virology, or go to the Bailey's website, our website, which is drsambailey.com, because there are hundreds, I'm telling you, hundreds and hundreds of articles, videos, publications where we have covered all of this material before. So, yeah, so that's a really important thing, is to say that whenever you get presented with someone, with something like a claim that one of these viruses exists, whether it's HIV or SARS-CoV-2, you have to ask yourself, how do you know this? Is this, am I just, you know, repeating, parroting what everyone else is saying around me? Mm-hmm. And we're just saying, as you say, Kevin, we're just taking it from a scientific point of view and taking a deep dive into literature. Now, and one thing I know, Dolores, you get asked, and we get asked too, is that if there is no virus, what on earth are the vaccines all about? Now, this is not a new problem with vaccines, because for any alleged viral entity on this panel here, because we don't believe that there is such a thing as pathogenic viruses, our investigations into the literature have shown that all of these vaccinations that date right back to things like Jenner, the smallpox vaccine, the late 1700s and onwards, it's all a scientific scandal, basically, because they never showed that there was an infectious particle. They never showed that these conditions could actually pass between people. And I know for some people that sounds incredible, that contagion, which is promoted by the entire medical and pharmaceutical industries and is thought to be common wisdom, but in fact it's not, there is no evidence that this contagion takes place. So, yeah, the entire premise of vaccines is fraudulent. And with something like SARS-CoV-2, the mRNA vaccines are simply based on sequences that are said to be viral in origin, but our research has shown that they have not established that these sequences are viral in origin. For example, the spike protein, the sequences were described as early as 1990 with cell culture experiments. So these are not new. The spike protein is not a new thing. It has been described for the last 3 or 4 decades. What we would contest is that it does not come from an entity called a coronavirus. We have seen it in environmental specimens. We've seen it in tissue breakdown experiments where they've identified the proteins and genetic sequences that have been called spike proteins. Mm-hmm. And basically the vaccine is based on those. Are the genetic sequences real? Probably. Do they belong to a virus? No, that's never been shown.
Yes. Yeah. I think that that's a key issue that the truth movement, the freedom movement, don't understand. We're not questioning. What we're questioning is the origin of this, of these phenomena, whether they're viral in origin, not whether they've been detected or not, whether they actually are viral in origin. And if they're not viral in origin, their provenance, then, of course, this lends total support to the critique of the so-called vaccines, the injections, the COVID injections, can only be dangerous. They can only ever be dangerous because the provenance of the genetic material upon they're supposedly based isn't viral at all. So it's a confection, really. It's an alchemy, a modern-day alchemy. I just wanted to maybe bring Mike back in here because, Mike, your comments about the methodology and the research, the way the research has been done in virology and tracking that back across all the different viruses that Mark's mentioned, and Mark and Sam Bailey's videos are very good on this. But the background to this you've got on your website, and as a citizen coming to this, as somebody with some science training, obviously, but what's your feeling about the future, really, and what we're talking about here, using non-authority sites, looking at, people like Sam and Mark Bailey that aren't mainstream doctors anymore. We're talking about reinventing our science information sources and citizen sources in a completely different way to before. What's your thinking about this?
Well, I'm excited about all this. I'm seeing, new names and faces popping up all the time. And I think a lot of it, for myself, I was driven by the censorship, the fact that when I started off, I was doing, just Facebook posts, just talking to friends and family and trying to get the information out to a smaller group. But as more and more people found what I was posting, I started getting censored heavily. Anything that I posted about PCR, any vaccination, even if it was just directly from the FDA or the CDC or the WHO, if I gave any sort of information from these that contradict the main narrative, I was banned. I was given a 30, there was one period where I went from like in 2 days from a 24-hour ban to a 30-day ban just because of, PCR, and they don't want anything out there counter to their narrative. And so that forced me to create the blog and to get this information out there in other ways. And I think that's what we've had to do, with different doctors and we've seen scientists like Mike Donio get out there and, create Telegram channels or getting on Odyssey and BitChute and doing their own videos. And it to me is exciting because we're seeing this movement, this uprising of people that are different backgrounds. But like for myself, you know, I consider myself just more of a normal person. You know, I do have a science background and everything, but you know, if I can look at this, you know, these old virology papers and make some sense of it, anyone can. It just takes a little bit of effort. You know, we have to be willing to not just accept what we were told, but to actually go back and research these things and look at the information for ourselves and see if it makes sense. You know, use some critical thinking skills, you know, use logic and discernment and look at this information. And so anyone can get out there and do this and can help share and spread the message. And I think that's what we're seeing, is a lot more people are rising up and joining groups. We're creating a community, whether it's through Telegram channels and different things. And to me, that's exciting. It's hopeful. We're getting around the censorship. And that's why I appreciate.
So in a way, sure. And so what you're saying really, well, what we're saying is that we're creating a new social movement. Is that the right word for it? That embodies citizens that are awake to the science, are self-aware, but they're actually tutoring themselves in a way with scientists like Dr. Sam and Mark Bailey, Dr. Tom Cowan, Dr. Andrew Kaufman, and all the others. And linking to Eric, what you were talking about some time ago, which is this links back to other environmental movements, doesn't it? Social movements around health and the environment, and how those came about, and how those embodied many of these truth issues around science, or maybe how some of these movements obstruct the issues around science. Because I think I'm sure some of you will agree that, you know, we haven't just been censored by the mainstream, we've also been censored within the freedom and the so-called truth movement. It's been quite hard sometimes to get heard by people that we think should hear us, but they haven't. They've actually obstructed us. It may be not overtly, but maybe tacitly, they've done it silently by leaving us off the agenda. Did you have any comments, Eric, to add into this?
Listening to this for a long time, and this morning, I keep being reminded that this is all about what people will believe. In the end, it is what people believe. It doesn't matter how right you are or how impeccable your proof is. It doesn't matter how well you understand something. It ultimately comes down to what they believe and find believable. And that's often a person that they find believable. And we have to stay in the realm of human psychology here and not ourselves get swept up in the technology. And I know that it's very hard when you've spent years mastering the history and the technology and you're carrying all that around in your body. In my experience, as many other people involved with the toxins issue, it comes down to, for example, explaining to a person who is at potential risk of toxins, that there is actually a risk that is not worth taking. And then it's going to come down to you versus the guy from the state standing there saying it's safe, and me or my soccer moms I've recruited to stand outside the dormitories when I thought, hey, why not, let's get some soccer moms to talk to these other soccer moms. And what I saw in that experiment was people just tend to believe the state authority. And so we have to get across that hurdle of belief, I think, more than anything. And what we know is that people will believe things that have their choice to believe is not on the basis of truth. This is very hard for people who spend their lives invested in studying and understanding the truth. And everyone on this panel has spent, I bet, at least 500 nights up till 4 a.m. trying to figure out the truth in the middle of all of this, because that's because we're the kind of people who do that. And it is difficult to understand that there are people who just simply don't do that. And when R2-D2 comes bumbling along, then R2-D2 is the truth. And this is why I'm saying we really need to have this conversation a lot, like playing tennis or some other thing, to get good at it and come up with engaging and funny ways to do this. And these things really stick, and they help get past the ego obstacles, the I am wrong, the I have these little shocking moments of revelation. There's a fellow in the neighborhood who, it's, I have to say, for the purpose of this conversation, is gay. And the fact that he's gay means that he's at one of the people who has had to, and very smart, had to understand the AIDS problem from the standpoint of being someone who was told over and over again that he is at risk. And one day he explained to me the entire Peter Duisberg theory of what was going on with AIDS and HIV. And then a week later, when I explained to him that my latest findings had been, well, no one can actually produce this SARS-CoV-2 virus, and it looks like they've got this problem with every virus, he said, you're not going to tell me that, I'll get me to believe there's no such thing as a communicable disease. Believe. You're not going to get me to believe it. And so I think we have to understand that we are up against this arbitrary, emotional, not logical factor in the human psyche. This is part of the human condition that's about belief. And part of belief is credibility, and part of belief is understandability. Part of belief is convenience, and part of belief is, what do I have to adjust if I now believe this new thing and all the old things I believed were not true? So there's a lot of factors there. There's skin in the game. People have that skin in the game. So when a parent, I've worked a lot on toxic dormitories, and signal me when I'm getting near the end of my time. They show up, they've driven all the way from Suffolk County, New York. They've made the 3-4 hour trip up to New Paltz. It's taken them years to plan the kids' college education. And they show up on the campus, and there's some people there saying this building was contaminated in a 1991 incident. They're heavily invested in dumping their kid in that dormitory and getting back on the road and going out to dinner, because it's the first day their kid is in school, and it's a big day in the life of the parents. They do not want to turn around with that child, young adult, and bring them back to whatever Ronkonkoma, New York, and the entire plans of the last 2 years are scuttled. This is what we're up against. We're up against belief, which is about convenience.
We are, and you can see how this has worked in the last 2 years, where you've had the virologists, you had the microbiologists, and then you've had them wrapped in the social scientists, the psychologists, the behavioral psychologists, and the sociologists. And I think that medical sociology here is quite a key area to bring in. We do know that intellectual understanding doesn't translate into human behavior. We've known this in health for a long time. A classic thing is, you know, smoking causes illness, therefore people should stop smoking. But it's a very, very trite equation there, a bit like Nancy Reagan's idea about how you cure drug abuse. You just say no to it, and you know it doesn't actually work. It doesn't
thank
actually
you,
work,
Kevin. You know. Kevin, just on that note, if that's okay, we'll just go for a quick break on the Dolores Cahill radio show on TNTRadio.live, and our guests today are Kevin Corbett and Dr. Mark Bailey, Mike Stone, and Eric Capolino, and we'll be back in 2 minutes.
TNT Radio's Jeremy Nell.
My worldview tends to be around a set of core values.
Sorry about and that, guys. Sorry for interrupting you, Kevin.
The radio is brutal.
Yeah, no, it is. And I was trying to get it that we wouldn't have a break, because I thought it might actually flow better. But as you can hear the messages, it's radio, not a podcast. Yeah. Fair play, Adam. Cool. All right. And then it's back to you, Kevin. You can go straight in after the break. And sure, I suppose think philosophically where, I don't know if you want to talk about the impact of this on society in the bigger picture as well. I don't know what you want to, you know, if people are listening to it.
I think what we should do is to wrap it up in the next 20 minutes with where we go forward with this, knowing that, you know, knowledge doesn't change behavior. Information alone doesn't change behavior. So if we're wanting to change people's behaviors, their understandings, we've got to continue doing this. We've got to produce the work. Doctors like Sam and Mark have got to continue doing what they're doing. Activists have got to continue doing what they're doing. We just need more of it, a critical mass, more of a momentum.
But the only thing is, you know, there's huge implications of this, right? Because people are not, like my uncle is dying and we can't see him because in the hospital. Well, I haven't tried yet because they'll probably kill him. But you know what I mean? The travel, the education, the virologists, the money for all this and the
just maybe curtailment. Someone else, you know, would be happy to go to organ donor.
The implication,
it saves lives.
It's significant if it's not
true. And Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.
Silence for thinking differently.
Okay, I'll just do a short, Kevin, and then go to you.
Silence for asking questions. Not here. Silence for discussing the other side of the story. Not on TNT Radio. Join the conversation anytime. Search TNT Radio on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Getter, or Gab. Download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Dolores Cahill Show on TNT Radio, and it's hosted by Dr. Kevin Corbett. So over to you, Kevin, again.
Before the break, I was talking about how we understand that knowledge on its own doesn't change behavior. So we can prove that viruses have not been proven. We can prove that their material reality is at least questionable, if not actually there. And this on its own is a very difficult message for so many people to take, because as Mike and Eric were saying before the break, you know, when RDT2 comes along, when the authorities come along and tell you something's true, 9 out of 10 people are going to go along with that. They're going to comply. And when a scientist tells you something's true, people automatically default to believing this is correct. And you can give people knowledge, information, and it doesn't change their understanding or their behavior. And I think for the future, this is what we're going to build on, this whole issue about how do we influence people and how have we influenced people. And undoubtedly, the work that we've done in the last 2 years has undoubtedly influenced the authorities. It's influenced the truth movement, the freedom movement, and it will continue to do that through the momentum that we're building up. So it is the case that we just need to do more of what we've been doing, and we need to do it in bigger numbers. And in the last couple of years, you can see that scientists have come on board. We've had scientists like Mike Donio coming out of this. We've had others coming out of the system. I know locally in the UK, I've had many microbiologists approach me anonymously, frightened of losing their jobs. And they've been following this debate with SARS-CoV-2 and with the other viruses well before the last 2 years. So I do think that this is an important issue to really advertise the effect that we're having, which is difficult to measure, but it's not difficult to qualify. It's difficult to quantify our effect, but it's not difficult to qualify the effect we're having. And we can see this on a daily basis. The other issues here is that we're not just fighting an issue like, a science issue. It's a sociological phenomenon we're dealing with, where the regulatory frameworks, the institutions of government and healthcare are totally captured by this whole viral myth. And they're creating epidemics as much as anything. And how do we go around this when all of this ideology is being wrapped up on a daily basis in terms of travel restrictions, social interaction restrictions, masking and all the rest that's sort of gone off the boil now, but could easily come back. So I think these are the important issues that we need to think about. How our antiviral ideology, our antiviral science, actually, because we're not just basing our work on belief, it's based on science. Our antiviral science is going to impact on the wider sociological, the institutions of government and healthcare, and on our daily restrictions, which can easily become more restrictive at the drop of a hat. We're in a power situation here as much as anything else. Power and knowledge, a very interesting couplet. And the institutions of virology are quite powerful. They've infected the biotech and pharma industries undoubtedly in the last 100 years. They've become instruments of this ideology, and that's the power base that we're having to confront. But power isn't just a top-down thing. Power and the power to act are very granular and very disseminated. And we are very powerful as a group, not just as individuals, but as a network, as a community, and as a new social movement, an antiviral social movement. So I think that we ought to be looking at some issues. And I'd like to just throw the door open, really, to Mark, Mike, and Eric to make some comments on this, perhaps, before we finish up.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin. Yeah, and I actually think it's a really exciting time. To me, COVID-19 has been a huge overreach by the perpetrators behind this fraud. And it's actually woken up more people than I think they anticipated. In 2020, and I know my fellow panelists would probably agree, it was pretty lonely when you said to people that the particle SARS-CoV-2 didn't seem to exist, even amongst very skeptical people about the whole COVID situation, that didn't really get a lot of traction. But soon we found that people were interested. They really were interested in the whole science behind virology and, in a wider sense, germ theory and the whole concepts of vaccinations as well. And we know too that the amount of censorship that we've been subjected to has been absolutely incredible. So we know the audience is there. It's just that we're getting a lot of interference from big tech and authorities with regard to how we can get that to more people. So yeah, I think it's the other thing I often ask people to do is to ask themselves, what is virology and the whole viral theory delivered for them, and getting them to reflect on that, because for most people it's brought them lockdowns, hardship in their own personal lives, whether that's for social or health or business reasons. It's brought them useless products in the forms of vaccines, which are not only pointless but dangerous, pharmaceutical products similarly, which do not help and only make people sicker. So if people really start to reflect what has actually been given to them in their health and well-being from this whole entity we call virology, I think it's easy for most people to see that it's not a whole lot at all. So yeah, I think exciting times in a lot of ways. And I actually think I think it's probably closer than we think to the whole house of cards falling down, because I think unlike in the 80s and 90s, and you'll be well and truly familiar with this, Kevin, with the HIV AIDS discussions that were going on then, it was very specific. It involved a much smaller group of people. The conversation was not really spilling out into a wider audience. And despite the fact that some incredibly important discussions went on, particularly with the likes of the Perth Group and Stefan Lanka and other great scientists who were speaking out at that time, for the average person on the planet, it wasn't something that affected them. AIDS and the concept of this fictional virus, HIV, were just a distant concept which didn't seem to have much relevance to most people. However, with the last 3 decades, we've seen these pseudo pandemics, these productions get bigger and bigger until they've just involved more and more people, until the COVID-19 pseudo pandemic, which has basically engulfed the entire planet. Now, although the perpetrators, this has been what they've been planning for some time, for population, it's been a giant wake up call, because now everybody's affected. And that's why you'll see people like myself and Sam, Mike Stone, Eric, Kevin, Andy Kaufman, Tom Cowan, Christine Massey, and all of the other activists out there. We're saying, okay, this has gone way too far. This is not some hobby industry. That this is something that's destroying the planet, basically, or destroying humanity as we know it. So, yeah, I think the critical mass, it's almost here. And I think we can see by the analytics on our websites, et cetera, that the audience is not getting smaller. It's getting bigger. More and more people are getting interested in this stuff. And like Eric said, although for us, it's an old conversation now, for many people, it's a new conversation. And we just have to get out there each week and keep on doing what we're doing.
And Eric, what did you like to say about this in relation to what we've just talked about?
I want to talk about getting over the hump of the belief issue. I think it's very important. And I get this from A Course in Miracles, partly, which talks about how belief is the kind of final filter, and you've really got to work with that. In the early 20s, I started drilling into this issue, and my assignment was the test. I knew that everything was coming back to this test, so I focused all my energy on that. And, well, not all of it, but like 60% of it. And then by the end of the year, I understood all the major, even by when I look at my notes and my articles in May, I understood all the issues. And some of them, I went back and looked at my March 2020 publications, and I understood all the issues in March of 2020. It's all there in March of 2020. But I still couldn't let go of the idea that there was some form of a virus. This is a very powerful thought form. It is God for most people, or it is the God particle for most people. And this is a usurpation of another natural concept. And so I had all the information I needed. I completely understood what was going on. I had been in touch with someone very close to the retraction paper. All through 2020, I was warned in advance it was coming out. I had all the information I needed. Nobody was convincing me of anything. I was involved in a dialogue to extract the information with a biochemist in Italy. In any event, by November, I still believed there was a virus. And I wake up one morning, I get a phone call, and I'm asked to show up with all my gear at this place in the middle of nowhere, where Cowan and Calvin were going to speak together for the first time. So it was around this hour of the morning. I'm gathering all my stuff in various places mixed in with guitar amplifiers to get to this thing on time, where there's going to be 130 people in this place with no distancing and no masks against lockdown. And it was only from that day's experience of being in the room after 8-9 months of this insanity that I completely let go of the concept of a virus. And I stopped saying it's not COVID
it wasn't the intellectual back and forth on videos and reading journal articles. For you, the penny dropped. The key moment for you of awakening was actually in the moment with real people in the real environment.
Yeah, and the weeks after where no one got sick. And by the way, I never believed anybody's video. Cowan and Kaufman did not explain the virus issue to me. David Bettini did, in a long Socratic dialogue where I fought and wrestled with everything. No one gave me this. I built this. And even after all of that work, I absolutely understood the issues. But there was still this belief lurking around in my mind that I had to physically, biologically disprove by going to a place with 130 people acting normally, hugging and kissing and eating food and chowing down and little kids running around in a big potluck dinner, and then nothing happened. Nothing. It was like the scene from Dr. Strangelove where who's the British warrant officer who picks turns on the radio. You've got to collect all the radios. And why does he have to collect all the radios? Because if there had been if Washington D.C. had been nuked, it would be on the radio. So he turns it on and there's just music. And he goes back to the general who's pushed the button. And he says, "Well, I thought you'd be happy to know that there's, God damn it, put that down, put that, what, you know, I mean, maybe Captain, that's whatever, an issue. Get rid of that radio." So
maybe that's an issue there, you know, for Mike, because you know, Mike, the analytics on your website virology.com must be phenomenal because the hits. But I'm sure that you go beyond just the website; you engage with the users and you have a back and forth and you have a real dialogue with people that isn't just virtual. And that's I think what Mark was saying a minute ago about, you know, AIDS and HIV affected 40 years ago, a smaller demographic, a smaller group of people. And now this is SARS-CoV-2 has just blown the whole viral thing out in the open. And everybody's becoming a dissident to a greater or lesser extent. You know, everybody is not going along with it to a greater or lesser extent. So the amount of critical thinking now is exponential compared to the 1980s with HIV. I don't know whether you've experienced this with your website.
Oh yeah, definitely. You know, I've seen, that's actually one of the things that I'm really happy with, is just from doing this blog, it's created kind of a community of its own within the blog and in the comments. And just, you know, there's a lot of people that are very supportive or are finding the work and coming to this realization through there. But, you know, I'll get some people that maybe agree with some of what I say and disagree with other things. And, you know, well, I like to have a dialogue with people, because I think not just for myself, but for others, it can open up different avenues to explore these issues with, and maybe even bring about a better or deeper understanding. And you know, I've had a few different discussions with some people, I won't name names, but that I've had feedback from other people who found just these discussions, where, you know, it was kind of a debate, so to speak, on some of the articles, and they were enlightened just from those conversations. And you know, they thought of things differently. And I find with my interactions with people, it can lead me to, you know, do different research that I might not have been brought on to at the moment. And it makes me dig down deeper. But yeah, it's been amazing seeing this community grow, just not on the blog, but, you know, we have some groups on Facebook, the Infectious Myth group, which is an awesome group of like-minded individuals who get together and we share ideas with each other. You know, on Telegram we have groups, and we discuss these things back and forth. So you can definitely see a community really growing, and we're coming together, which is amazing. And so yeah, it's been very exciting from my outside perspective watching.
So would you all agree then that in a way we are part of a new social movement, if that's the right word? And by social, I don't mean, you know, I mean in a broad sense, includes scientists, includes people looking at deconstructing virology, looking at rebuilding science, I think, in a new way, based on truth and based on the accepted tenets of science, accepted basis, accepted axioms, the postulates which have been ignored in virology. And is it possible that we could rebuild a new health science here that is because we've got the components there already. It's all there. You have the scientists, you have the health scientists, you have the practitioners, you have the activists, and very often those labels, those categories are all overlapping because we've all had some science training. We all are working as activists as well as scientists and as practitioners in our own way. So in a way, we embody all these functions within a social movement. What do you think about this? Would we call it an antiviral social movement? Or what sort of term, what sort of name would we give this new social movement?
It's spiritual.
I like that name. Go ahead. The antiviral. Oh, I was just going to say, I like that antiviral name. I completely agree that, we're getting out there and it's not so much, I mean, you could look at it like we're creating or trying to establish a new science, but I think also I look at more just getting back to the basics, you know, the science that's been ignored, the scientific method and holding them to actually performing science the way it was meant to be. And they're not doing
it. So what you're saying, Mike, is it's more of a scientific renaissance, we're talking about here.
Kevin, I was thinking of calling it like an integrity movement or integrity project, right? You know, if someone says something, they just have to be challenged and then put it in a repository and let it be checked in the world. So it's to bring integrity back to science and research.
And what do you think, Mark and Eric? Eric, you've got your hand up. What do you think about this?
I mean, very briefly, quickly, I want to leave a minute for Mark to speak. People need to feel better. I think that there's a lot about just feeling better, and I think that this is really that's what this is going to come down to. It's tough to be alive right now. There's so many assaults and so much stress and so much pain, and we need to feel better. And I think if we can focus on that, we've got something. And isn't this what doctors are supposed to help us with in the first place, is feeling better?
And Mark, what doctor, did you think about that?
I want to feel better, doctor. What do I do?
Yeah, I used to be in the medical system, and it's not the place you go for health, to be honest. I think the medical system does its own thing. It's self-serving. Health is actually really simple, and one of the frustrations Sam and I have with the work we're doing at the moment is that we spend so much time dismantling the bad medical science that we'd love to spend more time just talking to our audience about how to be healthy. Mm-hmm. And it's actually really simple. It basically comes down to diet, psychological and spiritual considerations. There's really not a lot more to it. It's very simple. Now, our household, we've got three children, and we embrace a very holistic health lifestyle and are all incredibly healthy. And we'd like to definitely share with the world how we do that. And it's actually quite simple. One thing we've got in the pipeline is we are rebooting a book by a New Zealand doctor from the 1930s and the 1940s, which was heavily suppressed and not welcomed by the medical community. So Sam and I have decided to publish the book once again, and it is just an absolutely outstanding publication.
We just have the last minute, Mark. What's the book called?
The book was originally called Hints on Healthy Living by Ehrlich Williams. He changed the title, and we're probably going to change it again for the 6th edition, which hopefully will be out soon. But
great.
Yeah, my take on it is you don't need a lot of medical science to be healthy. It's much more simple than you think.
Great, great. So we're just going to have to leave it there. And I would like to sincerely thank Kevin Corbett, Dr. Kevin Corbett, for hosting the show. It was wonderful. And also our guests from New Zealand, Dr. Mark Bailey, and from America, Mike Stone and Eric Capolino. And thank you also, Kevin. Thank you very much to everyone.
Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you, team. Bye now.
Bye-bye, everyone. Very good. And that's it from the Dolores Cahill Show on TNTradio.live. Wow. What do you think, guys?
That went quick.
Are you happy, Kevin? Show.
Go to episodes at tntradio.live.
We can never get everything out there, but I think it was really good.
With a look back at what made news this week, I'm Matt Borland.
Eric,
despite being defeated by a crushing landslide in Tuesday's primary election,
was brilliant.
U.S. Congresswoman Liz Cheney confirmed she's considering running for president.
Feed in.
And it'll be on a podcast on TNT Radio on Monday.
That I will do whatever.
And Kevin, if you want to do it again in a month or two, because I think the fraud and everything is, you know, the implications of all this is really powerful, you know, for legislators and politicians and everything.
Cheney pulled only 28% of Tuesday's vote.
Thank you. Thank you, Kevin. Take a bow.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Mike. Thank you for getting up so early, Mark, Mike, and Eric, and Mark.
And used her concession speech to compare herself to America.
Keep in touch, guys. Take care. God bless. Bye-bye.
Of our party, Abraham Lincoln, was defeated in elections for the Senate and the House before he won the most important election of all. Lincoln ultimately